Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Lucerne, Switzerland, and from 1986 to 1988 served as Pontifical Swiss Guard, protecting Pope John Paul II the Great. He's the author of The Pope and the CEO, John Paul II's Leadership Lessons to a Young Swiss Guard. He is the Director of Entrepreneurship Programs at the Catholic University of America. His name? Andreas Widmer, who worked for a saint. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Andreas Widmer, who was a Swiss Guard protecting the Pope for a couple of years. Andreas, welcome. What an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. The honor is mine.
You grew up in a little town, Lucerne, Switzerland. You were the youngest of six children. You're 6 foot eight. My first question is, how did you ever get so big being the youngest of six kids in a little town?
Protective mother.
What did she feed you?
I grew up on cheese and yogurt and milk. That certainly helped.
Talk to us, if you will, about your mom and dad and your childhood.
So I often say it as a joke, but the truth is, I pretty much grew up like Heidi. You know, we were the only non-farmers in the village. The village is 400 people. It's a bit outside of Lucerne. And everybody were farmers except us. And so I grew up like a farm boy, you know, milking cows and harvesting and the whole thing. And definitely very rural, beautiful childhood. Most of the time, we were just outside. And everybody knew everybody. Very idyllic, beautiful, idyllic childhood. And I'm a cradle Catholic. My parents brought us up there. I mean, see, Switzerland is divided by regions into, you know, there were wars about religion, about Protestantism and Catholicism. And I grew up in the Catholic part. So everybody in the village was Catholic. And there was one church, it was a Catholic church. And had a very beautiful childhood, thank God.
You've had a beautiful life. How did you ever become a Swiss Guard?
So one of the downsides of being the youngest of six is that you grow up thinking that you're not really good at anything, because everything you're doing, if you have siblings who are older than you, they're better than you at it. And so I questioned and I sort of struggled to find my place. And who am I? What am I doing? I sort of had, in that sense, a low self-esteem and a low expectation of myself, and just couldn't find my place. And the only thing I could really do well was, because of my size, I could fight well and did very well in the Swiss military. I was a Boy Scout all the way through, which oddly enough in Switzerland is actually connected. It has connections to the military. We're a militia. Everything is connected to the military. And so I excelled at that, but not at much more. I was very horribly struggling in school. And then a friend came back to the village and said that he was a bodyguard. And that just blew me away. And I thought, where do I go? That's what I want to do. That's the coolest thing. And so I applied. And, of course, you know, he said it was the Pope and everything, but that didn't really mean anything to me. I became a Swiss Guard because being a bodyguard or becoming and being trained as a bodyguard was about the coolest thing I could imagine at the time.
The Swiss Guards have been around and protecting the Pope since 1506. Tell us about the Swiss Guard.
So you see, the Swiss were famous mercenaries, and as many things like this, it grew out of necessity. In Switzerland, with the farms, if you would split your farms by how many children you have, everybody would end up farming on a postage stamp. So what the tradition is, the oldest one gets the farm, everybody else leaves. You know, and you have 10, 15 kids in the Middle Ages. Where are these kids going to go? And so what the men did, they grew up very strong and, you know, on the farm and everything. They would go and be mercenaries, fighters, soldiers. And they went to there was not a king in Europe who didn't have a Swiss military unit of these mercenaries. And they were state-of-the-art, the best. And so Julius II, back in 1506, had to defend the Papal States. And he kept losing and found out that the newest weapon are those Swiss ferocious soldiers. And he hired about 500 of them and started to go into battle. I think he tried them out in Venice first and then was so impressed. You know, back then the Pope would go into battle with them. And was so impressed that he made them his personal guards. And only a few years later, with Pope Clement, in 1526, the test came where actually the sack of Rome happened, and the Pope's very life was threatened, and the Swiss guards were defending the Pope. The Vatican was attacked, and they, you know, by thousands of soldiers, and they were only about 400 at the time. And they pretty much suffered martyrdom by delaying the thousands of troops coming in and having a few assigned to go save the Pope in the St. Angel's Castle. And you can still see it next to the Tiber there, by running with him in there, and that was impenetrable. And so ever since then, the popes have given the Swiss guards the title of defenders of the freedom of the church.
We're talking to Andreas Wibner. Andreas, what's a typical day in the life of a pontifical Swiss guard?
So we go in rhythms. There are duty. There is rhythm of night duty, day duty, and then special duty or time off. So the night duty would start about 8 o'clock in the evening, and you would go until 8 o'clock in the morning. That can be with breaks to sleep in between. The day duty is from 8 to 8 again. Those are usually protecting securing the main locations where the Pope lives. So we don't have any responsibility for the Vatican, only for the Pope as a person. But that means we secure certain areas like now Santa Marta, where Pope Francis lives, and the palace where he works. So we protect both of those, but then not, let's say, the gardens of the Vatican or the museum and all that. We have nothing to do with that. So that's what we usually secure with these two shifts. And then the special duty is whenever the Pope moves out of those secure areas, we go with him as the first unit or the first few circles of protection, which means a very erratic life. The one thing I always remember about being a guard is that you can't get used to this rhythm, that you always feel you have a lack of sleep, so to speak.
We're talking to Andreas Wibner. When we come back, we'll ask him how he first met Pope John Paul II. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Andreas Wibner. Andreas, take us back to December 24th, 1986. I think it's your first duty as a pontifical Swiss guard. What happened?
It was my first day of duty, but by chance, because you see, when you enter in the guards, you go through a recruit school process, and there is a test at the end of that, and once you pass that test, you're done. And I did pass that test a day or so before the 24th, and then expected not to have to go to work until January 1st. But I did have to go to work. The sergeant found me and somebody got sick, and they put me into service before I was really before I was really supposed to. And so that day actually is where I come from, the Christmas is celebrated on the 24th mainly, not the 25th. So the vigil of Christmas is very important. And of course, also in the Swiss Guards, this is celebrated at night. And when I grew up in our village, we would always have a wonderful family celebration. It was my favorite holiday, really. And so, lo and behold, this sergeant tells me on that day that I'm going to work that night, which is 8 to 8. And it just shattered me. This is after I arrived there, I'm lonely, I don't know the language, I don't know anybody, and I feel totally let down by them making me work on that day, which I sort of felt like they singled me out. I called back. So the one thing is also that the commander gives you two gifts per year, which he did at the time, where you could call your family on Easter and on Christmas for free. And so, of course, there's 115 guards, and that whole day, everybody's trying to call home, and so did I. And I was waiting there in line, and I called home, and my dad picked up, and he was very happy to hear from me, and you know, he said whether they were going to keep me, and I said yeah, that I passed the test. And then he said, "What? So then go ahead and celebrate Christmas tonight." And I said that I, you know, I'm not actually, because I have to work. And he couldn't believe it. And then my mom takes the phone, and we talked in the previous segment that I'm the youngest, so I may be tall, but I'm still, you know, I have a special relationship with my mom. I'm her baby. And so she takes the phone and just starts to cry. And I, you know, when my mom cries, I just have to cry with her. And so, but there were 20 military guys standing behind me, so I couldn't really cry. And I had to, you know, it was my honor or my mother, and I hung up on her. Can you believe it? I hung up, and my tears came down my face, and I ran to my room. I changed into my uniform, and I went to duty. And the duty is, at the time I wasn't aware of this, but I was right. I was the last man, so to speak, before the Pope. So the Pope is protected in circles, and I passed all these circles all the way to the center to his apartment. And I was outside of the apartment that night, and it started at 8 o'clock, and it's dark in there. It is a little room. You sort of lock yourself. You have both keys. You lock yourself in there. And I just had what I would call the perfect emotional storm. I just accused myself. You know, you're better at accusing yourself than anybody else can accuse you. And I just was up there saying, what in the world are you doing? This whole tough guy image you're putting out, that's all, you know that's baloney. That's not true. And deep inside, I just wanted my mom, and I wanted to go home and just forget about the whole thing. And I just cried up there like I just dissolved. And then after some hours, the radio goes off, and the commander says, Widmer, the Pope is going to go celebrate midnight mass, and he's going to use your exit to, you know, let him out. And I was like all startled, and I said, oh, okay, and the way you do this is you unlock the door so he can come out, and then the other door as well so he can pass, and then you lock yourself in there again, so that's really you're the last measure of security. And this huge door opened up, and into my little room came this beautiful yellow light from the hallway of the Pope's apartment. And in the doorframe stood John Paul II in his white cassock and with the little white zucchetto that he wears. And he's a pretty sturdy guy, and he stood right in the doorframe looking at me. And he had this habit that when he was interested in something, he would tilt his head a bit. And he looked straight at me, and he pointed at me and said, hey, you're new. I've never seen you before. What's your name? And I was so startled. I basically said, you know, I pretty much just gave him my social security number, you know, like in the military. And he comes forward, and he reaches out his hand to me. And I look down, and I reach his hand. And then he looks up, and I look up, and our eyes meet. And I immediately thought, uh-oh, that, you know, my eyes must have been bulging red. And he immediately noticed. And he didn't ask any questions, but he just, I saw his concern right away. And he says, of course, this is your first Christmas away from home, isn't it? I tell you, that was the wrong thing to say to me. I couldn't say anything. But tear comes down my cheek, and I'm looking at him, and he didn't want an answer. He just came closer, and he held my hand, and then with the other hand he held my elbow. He sort of pulled me in, and he had these light gray eyes and looked me deep in the eyes and said, you know what, Andreas, I really appreciate what you're doing. You know, you're doing a sacrifice here tonight, and I want to just have you know that I appreciate what you're doing. I am going to tell you what, I'm going to go now and celebrate midnight mass, and I'm going to pray for you. And then he left. And to me, this was like, you know, to me, this wasn't the Pope. To me, this was the first person who paid any attention to me. You know, I was like suffering, and this was the man who reached out. I didn't have the catechesis that I properly understood what the Pope was and who this is and everything. All he was to me was the one person out of 115 people that I was living with who reached out and basically embraced. I was reduced to a 7-year-old in front of that door. And he embraced that 7-year-old and said, it's going to be okay, and I am going to pray for you. See, he didn't say, do this or do that. You know, you should do more of this. He said he would pray for me. And at the time, I wasn't even really a faithful Catholic. And I feel that was the change. That was the beginning of my conversion to become a faithful Catholic.
Andreas, he was also the most sane person in the history of the world. So, starting with his first address at Pope, as Pope, the statement he kept repeating to us over and over was, "Be not afraid." Tell us about that mantra of his.
You see, one of the things that he started to talk to us about, and you know, the beauty is he ministered to the Swiss Guards. He ministered to everybody he was in touch with. Often people feel like he may have come to Detroit or something, and you're one in 100,000 people, and you feel he spoke to you. Well, that's how anybody felt who was even close to this man. And he would minister to us in the sense that he would start to say, I can't wait to see the great good you're going to do. That isn't that he would lower. See, to me, Christianity was always this high ideal that I could never achieve, and I'm just not good enough for this. And so, you know, the saints are all the way up there, and I'm all the way down here. Well, that's not what he taught us. What he taught is more like a coach rather than a critic. And the coach knows you have to go to the Olympics and you have to jump a certain height or be so fast or that. But the coach has confidence that you're going to do it. He has confidence in your ability and knows that you have to train, but he cheers you on, whereas a critic says, you're not good enough. And he was a coach in that sense, that he would say, you're going to be doing such great things with your life, and you call to holiness. And then the rhythm of be not afraid of this. It might seem scary that you're called to these lofty ideals, but you can do it. And it's going to be, you know, what he talked about. It's like you're an eagle. You know, we're all eagles, and our culture is bringing us up as chickens, if you wish. And somebody comes to you and says, "You're supposed to fly. You're supposed to be the king of the skies." And you're saying, no, I'm not. And if we would use the two wings we have, the faith and reason, we could soar to the heights and open up new vistas and really transcend. And he says, "Don't be afraid of this. Pursue it and believe in it." And holiness and sainthood is something that is achievable. As a matter of fact, we're called to it. So don't be afraid of it. That confidence he had in us, that really motivated. It gave me, he had more confidence in me than I had in myself.
We're talking to Andreas Widmer. When we come back, we'll ask him about the book he wrote, about what he learned from the Pope. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Andreas Widmer, the author of The Pope and the CEO, John Paul II's Leadership Lessons to a Young Swiss Guard. What's the biggest things he taught you, Andreas?
Well, the biggest thing he taught me is when I started to see him and I was 20 and this wannabe tough guy, and I see this man who lives well. So he lives, everything he does well. He's fully present. He prays well, and he had fun well, and he did sport well. One day I saw him, and I thought, whatever this guy has, that's what I want. And I thought that he had this, you know, what we often do today. We see, this guy's over there, and I'm all the way over here. But he would say, what I have, anybody can have. I have Jesus Christ and a personal relationship with Christ, and this is something you can have too. And if you like the way I pray, you can pray like that too. This is learned. This is something everybody can do. I think that's the biggest gift he gave me. I admired him, and he wouldn't take my admiration, but he pointed it to Christ. So how often today in our culture, you know, we admire, and it's like this stardom, and people are fans, and they have these idols and everything. John Paul, when he received this, he would turn into a sign, and he would point at Christ and say, you know, what you're seeing is not me. I have what he gives me. And he would point me to Christ, and that's how I found my faith. And so that's definitely the biggest thing he gave me. But then he also gave me a lot on the path to for my work. Although, you know, he gave me, you know, he sort of sowed the seeds that would later flourish in my life, because it's not so that I met him and then everything was good afterwards and I got everything right away. Not at all. You know, conversion is a is one step forward and two steps back. Eh? And so I went into business life afterwards, and I was very blessed with a very successful career as an entrepreneur and a business leader. And it took a while, but one of the things, it took all the way for me to burn out and make and lose a lot of money and sort of be successful and starting to think that success is me rather than a gift. And one of the things later on that he showed me, you know, it's sort of thinking back and reading what he says and so on, is that work is really a gift. And work is our gift of, when the first thing we know about God is that God is a worker. God works. God made the world. The first thing we know is that he worked. And that he then created us in his image and likeness, also as workers, also as creators. And so our privilege, first and foremost in marriage, to create an immortal soul of a new human being, that's the highest privilege. It's even a sacrament. That's so high of a privilege. But in business, we are called to create, you know, to think of something and work with it with our hands or our mind, and then create this product, and off it goes. And it sort of becomes our thought corporeal, and it moves, it takes on a life of its own almost. That is a privilege where we imitate God. John Paul would say, through work, we not only transform nature and adapting it to our needs, but we also achieve fulfillment as human beings. In a sense, we become more. We don't just make more, we become more. Without work and without working, we're not fully human.
How many of us can say our former boss was a saint and mean it literally? Andreas, let's talk a little about John Paul II's pastoral acts of love. Tell us about the homeless priest who the Pope invited to dinner.
So there was this American priest who was at a conference in Rome, and you know, many times these conferences, at some point the Pope shows up and participates and maybe has an audience with them. And this priest was at this conference and knew that this afternoon there would be the audience with the Pope, and he prepared. The morning session was over. He went back to his hotel to freshen up and then went to celebrate Mass at a church somewhere close, you know, in the center of Rome, somewhere close to the Vatican. And he, as he walked in, his eyes met this homeless guy who was sitting in front of the church begging, and he just thought, you know, these eyes, that he just it just stopped him in his tracks. And as he went to say Mass, it kept coming back to him, these eyes. I know, you know, they look so familiar. And then after Mass, he comes back out and he goes to this guy and says, "Do I know you?" And this homeless person replied in perfect English, said, "Yes." You know, first of all, he kept telling him to go away. And then he said, "Yes, we went to seminary together. And we were actually ordained together. But, you know," he says, what happened to you then?" He says, "Oh, you know, leave me alone." He fell into all kinds of trouble, and he was very angry and bitter, and basically kept telling this guy to go away. And eventually he did, this priest. He left and was just shaken to his core. And that afternoon then, the Pope walks by in the audience and says a little bit, you know, it wasn't a huge conference, so he spoke with everybody a little bit. And this priest, of course, says, "Holy Father, you'd never believe what happened to me today. I need you to pray for this homeless priest." And he told him the story. And the Pope was saying, "Yes, I certainly pray," and moved on. And then when at the end of the audience, at the time Monsignor Civish came over, the secretary to the Pope, and said to the priest, "Listen, you go get that priest, and he wants you to come to dinner to the papal apartment tonight." And this priest goes back into town and finds the priest, the homeless guy, still sitting at the same place, and says, "Listen, you and I, we're going to have dinner with the Pope tonight." And this guy goes, "Ah, you're crazy." And besides, once he said, "No, it's real," he says, "Well, I'm not going." And he says, "Yes, you are. Like, you're my ticket to go have dinner with the Pope. So, yes, you are coming. I don't even have anything to wear." So he brought him to his hotel room, freshened him up, shaved him, and gave him his clothes, and went to dinner with the Pope. And then during dinner, it was a nice, friendly dinner, and they talked about all kinds of things, but not really much about the elephant in the room, until Monsignor Civish told this priest, "Come with me, I want to show you something." and he was going to show him the chapel and so on. But basically, just to get the two of them out of the room to have the Pope and the homeless men be in the room alone. And when they were, and so this priest goes out, and then at the end, the tour was over, and Chibi said, look, they just need some time in there. Let's just wait here. I'll get the sign when he's ready. And they were waiting outside, and then after a while of waiting, Chibish got the sign, and they went back in, and then they had dessert, and, you know, Pope gave him the blessing and said, don't forget, you know, and then they leave. And as soon as they leave, this Pope goes to the homeless man. Now, what were you doing in there? I mean, what took so long? And he says, you'd never believe. He basically said in there that he wanted me to, you know, I'm a priest forever, and that he wanted me to go back into ministry. And I told him that I couldn't do that because he has no idea all the things I've done and so on. And then the Pope says, yes, I can. I will hear your confession, and then I am the Bishop of Rome, and I will reinstate you. And so then the priest says, so then what did you do? And he said, well, then I gave him my confession. And then he said, okay, I want you to go to this church and go to Father so-and-so, and you're going to be the ministry for the homeless in Rome. You're going to be the main priest for that now. And then he said, and then the priest said, the homeless priest said, and then he asked me, Father, would you hear my confession? And he says, wow. And he says, and the homeless priest says, and that's what took so long. So, and then this homeless priest and the priest left and went to that church. And from what I understand, this priest is still there leading the homeless ministry.
We're talking to Andreas Widmer, who worked for St. Pope John Paul II, who was an army of one. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a fabulous storyteller with a fabulous topic, Andreas Widmer. If you want to learn more, go to thepopeandtheceo.com. Thepopeandtheceo.com. Andreas, this saint was a magnet. He was magic with the youth of the world. Why?
Because he showed us the possibility and the real presence of what we can have with Christ. Too often in Christianity, Christ is portrayed as either almost as a historic figure or as somebody all the way over there and not active in our life. And I think what John Paul did is to show us how close Christ is to us and how real Christ is to us. And that is so electrifying. It changes everything. It changes fundamentally, it changes your life. And I think that's this huge message of hope. It's scary. That's why he keeps saying not to be afraid. And my challenge for anybody, or my invitation to anybody who's listening to this, is also to not be afraid and engage. You know, many of us say, well, I've never really heard God, or I've never had a profound experience, but you can. And I want to challenge you to take a time and go and be in silence and go towards Christ, go to the Adoration Chapel or something. I've seen John Paul, how he brought all kinds of things. It's not... You don't only have to do this with formal prayers, although formal prayers help us because they give us a structure. Next time you have to make a big life decision, even or write a paper or write a business plan or do anything, go in silence and go in front of the Lord and bring like a legal pad with you and start writing and have this discussion. If you want to know about your vocation, about what the Lord has to say, go there and take a note paper. You know, literally take the note paper with you and have this discussion. You'll be amazed that he's waiting there. What's missing is for you to go there and go there regularly and listen. And if you write things down, that helps for me, is that you can then see the progress in the message that you're receiving.
Andreas Widmer, did you ever realize that each day you were in the presence of a saint?
In retrospect, you do. When this happens, all you know is that you want to have more of who's in front of you. that whole idea and what Jean-Paul makes so beautifully clear to us, do not think of him as somebody who walks without making noise or never gets angry or isn't real. Sainthood is real. Sainthood is you and me. If you listen to this and you want to go to heaven, you better become a saint. And being a saint is achievable. This is not some far-out ideal. This is something we're all challenged to and invited to, and with the grace of God, we can do this.
One of the many, many things he was famous for was prayer. They used to say that he makes decisions on his knees, and he had an unbelievable love and devotion to the Blessed Virgin. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
You know, it was actually during the rosary that I saw him, where when he prayed, I started to feel different. And this is sort of when I'm still on the fence. You know, many people are comfortable because they're on the fence. Being an atheist is a tough thing to do. I always respect them because that's like living in darkness or without hope, in a sense that I'm not accusing them, but I'm saying it's a difficult thing to do. Most of people who don't dare, they become agnostics and say, well, maybe, maybe not. And that's where I was sitting. But then when I see him pray and I start to feel differently, then I'm saying, so what's going on here? And he would later give me the rosary and say, why don't you pray? You pray this. And I'm going, yeah, my grandmother prays the rosary. I'm not going to do this. And he says, no, do it. And some of the people around him taught me how to pray the rosary contemplatively. And I started to do this. And it was actually through the rosary that I had this profound experience of God, a profound experience of the presence of God. Not, you know, God doesn't speak to me through in a verbal way or so, but it's a profound presence. It's like if somebody stands right next to you. And that was really the core of my conversion. It's the rosary that he gifted to me that caused my most profound conversion.
He was the global pope. He was the most seen person in history. And on April 2nd, 2005, he passed. And during that week-long celebration of his life worldwide, I heard one priest say that first he taught us how to live, and then he taught us how to die. How, Andreas, how do you explain the unprecedented outpouring of love throughout the world upon his death?
He was a very courageous man, and he knew how to communicate. He was a top communicator. And think about it, how he communicated and never stopped communicating even after he lost his voice. Remember that image where we all watched how he came to the window and he couldn't speak anymore. He tried, and he couldn't. You know, they put the microphone in front of him, and he's trying to say something, and nothing comes out. And then eventually they take the microphone away, and he blesses everybody. But he stands there and doesn't go away. Most people in that state would go and hide somewhere or not want to be in the spotlight and seen. But I think on that day, on that window, he taught us more than most people do, you know, with 50 volumes of a book. Namely, he showed us the beauty and the dignity of human life, even when you're suffering, even while you're dying. I think that's a message that hasn't even really sunk in yet of his ministry and of the ministry of the church in general, that today still we think that suffering is a very negative and a useless thing, and that we have to one of the things he used to say is, be careful that when you try to prevent or fight suffering, when you try to eradicate suffering, don't eradicate the sufferer. You see that he says by us trying to alleviate suffering, we actually get rid of the sufferer. So you kill the sufferer and then think suffering is gone. But that's a fallacy, and I think he bore witness to that to the very moment he died.
His funeral was probably the most viewed funeral on earth, and Cardinal Mitre told me that, who was there, said, Jack, here you have a dead man with almost no possessions and no more power in a simple pine box. And to that left of that pine box were 400-plus of the world's leaders with all the power in the world. As you watched that funeral, what were your thoughts?
It is true that this man... people think of the papacy and they think of money and everything. This man never owned a bank account. He never really owned anything. I mean, he was poor. He never had any possessions. When I saw this, I was there too, and there were people next to me. I wanted to go as a pilgrim there. You know, I'm still involved in the guards, and so it would be easy for me to pull some strings and trying to get to the front, but I wanted to be there for him as a pilgrim to say, I want to be here as me you know, from my 400 people village and just come here and pay homage. And you don't do this in the front, you do this in the masses. And so I went, just I just stood in line like everybody else, and I ended up being smack in the middle of the square. To the right of me was a group of Anglicans, I mean people from London who happened to be in Rome, and they weren't Catholic, they were Anglicans, and they were so moved and so touched. And left to me were some Muslims who were also there, and they, and this moment of unity and this moment of universal admiration and respect that transcended even religion. Because when you see a great soul with who speaks the truth, then that is just universally appealing. And I think that's the testimony of, you know, that celebration of his funeral is one of the highlights, spiritual highlights of my life.
As our time winds down, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
What I would give you as an advice, if you listen to this, is to think about your vocation, to think about your life in three terms. So the one, think of your vocation as a map, like a map of a city, right? And the, and you're a point A in the upper left corner, and you need to go to point B in the lower right corner. And point B is heaven. All of us need to go through this city somehow and get to point B, and the other side is heaven. That's our universal vocation. The next step you do is you decide what car you're going to use to get there. That's your primary vocation. Are you called to drive in that sense by being a priest or a religious or a single person or a married person? Very, very important to know what's the vehicle that you're going to use to drive towards your holiness, towards heaven. And then the secondary vocation has to do with your work. What are you called to do on a daily basis? What's the work, that your sanctifying work? When you, what gifts did God give you to reach holiness? That third level are like the roads you take. So you have the whole map in getting through from here to heaven. You have the car which you're driving to get towards heaven, and then the secondary vocation is your profession, which is the exact road you're going to take to get to heaven. And if you always think of it in those three terms, I think that's a beautiful visualization of what your life is about, and it helps you make good decisions for your life.
Andreas Widmer, you're a 6'8" world-class storytelling angel telling the world about a modern-day saint. Keep up the great work. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Fasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohon. Believe in yourself.